So, welcome back. Let us attempt to complete this evening the 10th chapter, Knowledge by Identity and Separative Knowledge. Again, he was typifying four different states of knowledge at the outset. Knowledge by identity, knowledge by direct contact, knowledge by separative direct contact, and separative indirect contact is also a kind of knowledge. Now, in the last paragraph, he's been describing what is knowledge by direct contact. But let's just briefly rehearse all of them. Knowledge by identity would mean that there is the wholeness of being all within itself. There is no division. One is that. That is oneself. The second kind of knowledge comes when this self regards itself as an object. It does not lose its ground of being, but becomes both the thing which is viewed and the being who witnesses that, all within one status of being. But a third, a tertiary power, as he says, develops when there is a little more distance. The contact with the object is not lost, but the self recedes a little to the back. So here, Sri Aurobindo, in this last paragraph, has been describing what is the nature of that direct contact, where all identity is not lost. There is not full separation, but subject and object are not seen as part of the same being. There is some sense of separativity creeping in. Still, there are powers of penetration, powers of perception, of conception, which take us from sheer to multiple identity within this brand of consciousness and type of knowledge. Pardon me. Now we continue. A separative knowledge arises when the sense of differentiation overpowers the sense of identity. The self still cognizes its identity with the object, but pushes to its extreme the play of intimate separateness. At first, there is not a sense of self and not self, but only of self and other self. A certain knowledge of identity and by identity is still there, but it tends to be first overstructured, then submerged, then so replaced by knowledge through interchange and contact that it figures as a secondary awareness, as if it were a result and no longer the cause of the mutual contact, the still pervasive and enveloping touch, the interpenetrating intimacy of the separate selves. Finally, identity disappears behind the veil, and there is the play of being with other beings, consciousness with other consciousness. An underlying identity is still there, but it is not experienced. Its place is taken by a direct seizing and penetrating contact, intermingling, interchange. It is by this interaction that a more or less intimate knowledge, mutual awareness, or awareness of the object remains possible. There is no feeling of self meeting self, but there is a mutuality. There is not yet an entire separateness, a complete otherness, and ignorance. This is a diminished consciousness, but it retains some power of the original knowledge curtailed by division, by the loss of its primal and essential completeness, operating by division, affecting closeness, but not oneness. The power of inclusion of the object in the consciousness, of an enveloping awareness and knowledge, is there, but it is the inclusion of a now externalized existence, which has to be made an element of ourself by an attained or recovered knowledge, by a dwelling of consciousness upon the object, a concentration, a taking possession of it as part of the existence. So this is a far cry from seeing the other as part of oneself. It is no longer an operation within the distinct and direct awareness of selfhood, but is something recoverable by penetration and by seizing outside. The mutuality permits that, but it is no longer, as we would say, knowledge by identity. The power of penetration is there, but it has no natural pervasiveness and does not lead to identity. It gathers what it can, takes what is thus acquired, and carries the contents of the object of knowledge to the subject. So it is an exchange. It is a transport that occurs. Data comes in, knowledge arises because of it. There can still be a direct and penetrating contact of consciousness with consciousness, creating a vivid and intimate knowledge, but it is confined to the points or to the extent of the contact. There is still a direct sense, consciousness sight, consciousness feeling, which can see and feel what is within the object, as well as its outside and surface. There is still a mutual penetration and interchange between being and being, between consciousness and consciousness, waves of thought, of feeling, of energy of all kinds, which may be a movement of sympathy and union, or of opposition and struggle. There can be an attempt at unification by possession of others or through one's own acceptance of possession by other consciousness or other being, or there can be a push towards union by reciprocal inclusion, perversion, pardon me, pervasion, mutual possession of all this action and interaction. The knower by direct contact is aware, and it is on this basis that he arranges his relations with the world around him. This is the origin of knowledge by direct contact of consciousness with its object, which is normal to our inner being, but foreign or only imperfectly known to our surface nature. So you might say this is a pretty good description of that second range of knowledge. Here we begin the third. This first separative ignorance is evidently still a play of knowledge, but of a limited separative knowledge, a play of divided being working upon a reality of underlying unity and arriving only at an imperfect result or outcome of the concealed oneness. The imperfect intrinsic awareness of identity and the act of knowledge by identity belong to the higher hemisphere of existence. This knowledge, by direct contact, is the main character of the highest supraphysical mental planes of consciousness, those to which our surface being is closed in by a wall of ignorance. In a diminished and more separative form, it is a property of the lesser superphysical planes of mind. It is, or can be, an element in all that is superphysical. It is the main instrumentation of our subliminal self its central means of awareness. For the subliminal self or inner being is a projection from these higher planes to meet the subconscious, and it inherits the character of consciousness of its planes of origin with which it is intimately associated and in touch by kinship. In our outer being, we are children of the unconscious. Our inner being makes us inheritors of the higher heights of mind and life and spirit. The more we open inwards, go inwards, live inwards, receive from within, the more we draw away from subjection to our inconscient origin and move towards all which is now superconscient to our ignorance. Ignorance becomes complete with the entire separation of being from being. The direct contact of consciousness with consciousness is then entirely veiled or heavily overlaid, even though it still goes on within our subliminal parts, just as there is also, though wholly concealed and not directly operative, the underlying secret identity and oneness. There is, on the surface, a complete separateness, a division into self and not self. There is the necessity of dealing with the not self, but no direct means of knowing it or mastering it. Nature then creates indirect means, a contact by physical organs of sense, a penetration of outside impacts through the nerve currents, a reaction of mind and its coordinations acting as an aid and supplement to the activity of the physical organs, all of them methods of an indirect knowledge. For the consciousness is forced to rely on these instruments and cannot act directly on the object. So through this separative indirect contact, we use these indirect means to assemble what is a working, if limited, knowledge. To these means is added a reason, intelligence, and intuition, which sees on the communications thus indirectly brought to them by the senses, etc., put all in order, and utilize their data to get as much knowledge and mastery and possession of the not-self, or as much partial unity with it as the original division allows to the separated being. These means are obviously insufficient and often inefficient, and the indirect basis of the mind's operations afflicts knowledge with a fundamental incertitude. But this initial insufficiency is inherent in the very nature of our material existence and of all still undelivered existence that emerges from the inconscient. So it is that inconscient mooring which arrives as we rise out of it at the necessity of establishing these indirect methods which lead to a rough-fashioned knowledge and direct our steps upwards to the revelation of more direct and eventually knowledge by identity, not even through direct contact, but knowledge by identity. So he's described here a span of being traceable by growing knowledge, uniting what is lost in materiality with what rises above into the superconscious. And now he makes that absolutely plain. The unconscious, he says, is an inverse reproduction of the supreme superconscious. It has the same absoluteness of being and automatic action, but in a vast, involved trance, it is being, lost in itself, plunged in its own abyss of infinity. Instead of a luminous absorption in self-existence, there is a tenebrous involution in it. The darkness veiled within darkness of the Rig Veda. Tama asi tamasa gudham. This is from Rig Veda, the 10th mandala, hymn 129, and this is verse 3. Which makes it look like non-existence. Darkness veiled within darkness, which makes it look like non-existence. Instead of a luminous inherent self-awareness, there is a consciousness plunged into an abyss of self-oblivion, inherent in being, but not awake in being. So this is the superconscient, pictured as light, that has fallen into the inconscient, which is the opposite, nestling itself in what is near to nescience, leaving light and becoming darkness, pitch blackness, leaving the unity of being and becoming disaggregated, etc., etc., leaving ananda and becoming the insentient. Yet, he says, is this involved consciousness still a concealed knowledge by identity? So it's still there. Knowledge by identity is there even in the inconscience. It carries in it the awareness of all the truths of existence hidden in its dark infinite. And when it acts and creates, but it acts first as energy and not as consciousness, everything is arranged with the precision and perfection of an intrinsic knowledge. Remember that this is an action of chit shakti, an aspect of true being. And so as it involves itself, it emerges first as shakti and then later reveals its nature as chit. First comes the energy, later the awareness. Behind all is the absolute indivisibility of real being, which seems to be divided, which seems to be darkened, but is present, imminent, tangible to the eye that can see. But it takes a superconscient eye, apparently, to see all the way into that inconscience. He continues, in all material things reside a mute and involved real idea, a substantial and self-effective intuition, an eyeless exact perception, an automatic intelligence working out its unexpressed and unthought conceptions, a blindly seeing sureness of sight, a dumb infallible sureness of suppressed feeling coated in insensibility, which effectuate all that has to be effected. So from that absolute being, if it is aware, obviously its conceptions must be real. That real idea of the superconscient, which Sri Aurobindo says is the nature of this supermental awareness. It is an unerring intuition, even acting in matter, even engrossed in the inconscient, still its action is governed by that automatic intuition. It is eyeless, but it is exact. It is automatic, even though it's unexpressed, even though it doesn't have thought. Its conceptions are effective. And all that has to be affected in the field of matter rising from the inconscience is done perfectly according to the laws of that materiality, reflecting the same sureness that the superconscience has in its own realm. So, as above, so below, in a sense, a darkened sense. He continues, all this state and action of the inconscient corresponds very evidently with the same state and action of the sure superconscience, but translated into terms of self-darkness in place of the original self-light. Intrinsic in the material form, these powers are not possessed by the form, but yet work in its mute subconscience. So in this dark contrary is the same secret reality. We can, in this knowledge, understand more clearly the stages of the emergence of consciousness from involution to its evolved appearance, of which we have already attempted some general conception. The material existence has only a physical, not a mental, individuality. But there is a subliminal presence in it, the one conscious in unconscious things, that determines the operation of its indwelling energies. If, as has been affirmed, a material object receives and retains the impression of the contacts of things around it, and energies emanate from it, so that an occult knowledge can become aware of its past, can make us conscious of these emanating influences, the intrinsic, unorganized awareness pervading the form but not yet enlightening it must be the cause of this receptivity and these capacities. In other words, if something is impinged upon the material object, it carries a record of that contact. And to further the argument, if there were a necessarily sensitive and penetrating consciousness looking into it, it could read the record of those contacts, those impressions that have been gathered. What we see from outside, he writes, is that material objects like plants and minerals have their powers, properties, and inherent influences, but as there is no faculty or means of communication, it is only by being brought into contact with person or object, or by a conscious utilization by living beings, that their influences can become active. Such a utilization is the practical side of more than one human science. But still, these powers and influences are attributes of being, not of mere indeterminate substance. They are forces of the spirit emerging by energy from its self-absorbed inconscience. This first crude mechanical action of an inherent absorbed conscious energy opens in the primary forms of life into submental life vibrations that imply an involved sensation. There is a seeking for growth, light, air, life room, a blind feeling out, which is still internal and confined within the immobile being, unable to formulate its instincts, to communicate, to externalize itself. An immobility not organized to establish living relations, it endures and absorbs contacts, involuntarily inflicts, but cannot voluntarily impose them. The inconscient is still dominant, still works out everything by the secret involved knowledge by identity. It has not yet developed the surface contactual means of a conscious knowledge. So we're still dealing with the early forms here. But capable they are of absorbing influences from outside. So they are affected by them, and they carry them as living energies, in a sense, within them. So there is no object that you can pick up that does not, in a sense, have a brute awareness, does not receive an emotion or a feeling from you that it is deeply ignorant of. In other words, it feels it, it registers it. It cannot respond to you, but it does feel that. And some sensitive soul picking it up can say, ah, this thing has been here, it has been there, and I press into it a conscious power and invest it with a blessing, and I pass this on to someone. And that thing, by golly, radiates that force, radiates that light, carries that blessing actively into the palms of another hand. This further development begins with overtly conscious life. What we see in it is the imprisoned consciousness struggling out to the surface. It is under the compulsion of this struggle that the separated living being strives, however blindly at first and within narrow limits, to enter into conscious relations with the rest of the world being outside it. It is by the growing amount of contacts that it can receive and respond to, and by the growing amount of contacts that it can put out from itself or impose in order to satisfy its needs and impulsions, that the being of living matter develops its consciousness, grows from inconscience or subconscience into a limited separative knowledge. And so you see, we've been talking about that last phase of knowledge. So even the brute material object, or that life which is not yet reflective, but moving about in a physical being, a physical frame, has within it a power of knowledge developing, growing, etc. And so we see the mother, for instance, as she reacts with life forms, with animals, with plants, with stones, etc., exhibiting an unusual capacity of feeling, of sensitivity, of compassion, of oneness, so that she brings out in them their secret nature, imparts upon them an energy to further their growth. And it is a lesson to us that when we live at the best part of ourselves, when we are in touch with the oneness that resides in us and in that also, that looking from soul to soul, from depth to depth, we encourage that growth in all whom we meet, in all that we meet. And that encouragement is arriving to us more and more, and we become aware of secret felicities to which we were first blind and now sensitive. And we advance and we grow and we share. We share not with some other self, but more and more with the secret knowledge that that is myself. In another frame, another body, there is only one. There is only one. So, one paragraph to go. We see then all the powers inherent in the original self-existent spiritual awareness slowly brought out and manifested in this growing separative consciousness. They are activities suppressed but native to the secret and involved knowledge by identity, and they now emerge by degrees in a form strangely diminished and tentative. First, there emerges a crude or veiled sense, which develops into precise sensations aided by a vital instinct or concealed intuition. Then, a life mind perception manifests, and at its back, an obscure consciousness sight and feeling of things. Emotion vibrates out and seeks an interchange with others. Last arises to the surface. Conception, thought, reason, comprehending and apprehending the object, combining its data of knowledge. But all are incomplete, still maimed by the separative ignorance and the first obscuring inconscience. All are dependent on the outward means, not empowered to act in their own right. Consciousness cannot act directly on consciousness. There is a constructive envelopment and penetration of things by the mind consciousness, but not a real possession. There is no knowledge by identity. Only when the subliminal is able to force upon the frontal mind and sense some of its secret activities, pure and untranslated into the ordinary forms of mental intelligence, does a rudimentary action of the deeper methods lift itself to the surface. But such emergences are still an exception. They strike across the normality of our acquired and learned knowledge with a savor of the abnormal and the supernormal. It is only by an opening to our inner being, or an entry into it, that a direct, intimate awareness can be added to the outer, indirect awareness. It is only by our awakening to our inmost soul or superconscient self that there can be a beginning of the spiritual knowledge with identity as its basis, its constituent power, its intrinsic substance. So we see, emergent from this separative consciousness, the arising of sense, the development of a life mind, the refinement into emotion, the arrival of the galloping but incomplete reason. We see that to gain access to the real knowledge, to that secret identity which we share with all, we have to develop an opening in the subliminal and an action based upon that opening. Both must be there. The awareness and taking an active stance in the front of our nature. But really, it is only when we find that psyche deep within, or that individuated self above, the Chaitya Purusha, the term Sri Aurobindo gave to the psyche within, the Jivatman, that individual aspect of the universal self above, and secretly they are one. One above, timeless, one here, moving, evolving in time. There we arrive at that which can give us a true and a sure knowledge. Next time, I think we take up chapter 11, the boundaries of the ignorance. So, let us turn to Savitri. This time we're in book one, the book of beginnings. Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. Two are the ends of the mysterious plan. In the wide, signless ether of the self, in the unchanging silence, white and nude, aloof, resplendent like gold-dazzling suns, veiled by the ray no mortal eye can bear, the spirit's bare and absolute potencies burn in the solitude of the thoughts of God. A rapture and a radiance and a hush, delivered from the approach of wounded hearts, denied to the idea that looks at grief, remote from the force that cries out in its pain, in his inalienable bliss they live. Immaculate in self-knowledge and self-power, calm they repose on the eternal will. Only his law they count and him obey. They have no goal to reach, no aim to serve. Implacable in their timeless purity, all barter or bribe of worship they refuse. Unmoved by cry of revolt and ignorant prayer, they reckon not our virtue and our sin. They bend not to the voices that implore. They hold no traffic with error and its reign. They are guardians of the silence of the truth. They are keepers of the immutable decree. A deep surrender is their source of might, a still identity their way to know. Motionless is their action, like a sleep. At peace, regarding the trouble beneath the stars, deathless, watching the works of death and chance, immobile, seeing the millenniums pass, untouched while the long map of fate unrolls, they look on our struggle with impartial eyes. And yet without them, cosmos could not be. Impervious to desire and doom and hope, their station of inviolable might, moveless upholds the world's enormous task. Its ignorance is by their knowledge lit. Its yearning lasts by their indifference. As the height draws the low ever to climb, as the breadth draw the small to adventure vast, their aloofness drives man to surpass himself. Our passion heaves to wed the eternal's calm, our dwarf search mind to meet the omniscient's light, our helpless hearts to enshrine the omnipotent's force. So, thank you. Next week, a new chapter. Namaste, Jai Ma.